This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week number 660, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you. iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode number 660. I'm Josh Flanagan, and just before I started to talk, Connor sucked in air and held it. And that's why I'm laughing. Because of 3-2, I heard silence. I was like, how long can I do this and just see if he doesn't exhale? And he passes out. Connor Kilpatrick is my co-host.
You just hear as I hit the desk.
Do I finish the show?
It'd be a lot shorter.
Well, it'd be harder because you're recording over there, so
that's true. It would just record till someone found me.
Yeah, that's gonna screw up your hard drive eventually. Yeah. We are a fanboy, and we have bad priorities. Eat our stack of comics. See what I was saying about that priority thing. Yeah. One of us picks their favorite book, and we call that the pick of the week. We're talking about that book. Other books from the week, patron pick, maybe listener mail, maybe current ons going. Ongoings, goings on.
Goings on.
I think that's the third one.
Goings
on. It's going though. I'm a big fan of that. It's an entertainment show. It's here to be fun. Maybe you'll learn something, but I don't know that that's our first priority.
No. It's definitely not. Education is not as low on the list.
No, not at all. It's a spoiler filled program. So there will be spoilers that we'll talk about what happens in the books. So if you look at the list of books that we list conveniently along with times, and you say, "Oh, I haven't read that one yet," you will know that we will talk about it. We might hinder that experience for you. We don't want to do that. So here's your warning: that's a thing that could happen. Brush up, right? Read your stuff, move forward. Unless it doesn't really matter if you get spoiled, because that's not what the experience is about. Your call, Connor. You had the pick.
I did, but I want to say that actually, education is not the low on the list. We like to reveal new things to people. Maybe they don't know about history of comics or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. But then there's the things we get wrong.
Well, that's true.
When you record a whole show about a book, and you're like, I don't know what this has to do with criminal. And at the beginning, it says, this is a criminal book. And we find that halfway through the show. But there's still, take us with a grain of salt, is my point.
Listen all the way through to the end.
True. Yes, always do that.
I had the pick, and all the books came out this week.
All of them.
I had, when it was all said and done, I read close to 30 books. Which was double the amount I've read two of the last 3 weeks. So it was a very stressful week. But the good news is a lot of good ones, which makes this kind of week much more palatable. If this had been a week with a lot of medium to low quality books, it would have been bad.
You're really right, because I did have a moment where, like, there was a lot of books. I was like, Jesus, I'm never going to get through these. But there were multiple times where I finished a book and I was like, wow, that was good. And I thought to myself, I was like, yeah, I still like these, which is a thing that I had to examine. But it really was a moment. I was like, wow, that was a great superhero book. And I was like, I'm not completely dead yet, so let's carry on.
Yeah, I had I don't know, four books I could have made pick at one point during my reading. I kept changing it as I was reading through my digital stack of books. So, oh, that's the pick. Oh, no, maybe this is the pick. And then I got to the end and it was Mr. Miracle number 12. Perhaps it had to be Tom King, Mitch Gerads, Clayton Cowles. I think this was probably a controversial book for many people who read it. The reason why I was picked, beyond the expert craft involved we've talked about to death throughout the course of this run, is that when I read it, I thought one thing, and then when I stopped reading it, because it was the last book I read, and sat down, and I thought about it for a while. It was sort of running through the back of my mind as I was doing other things, and then I had to drive somewhere, and I thought about it the entire drive, and I realized something about it, and sort of put the pieces together of the story, and I thought, oh, wow, any book that can make me sort of sit and think for the half hour after I've read it is the pick of the week.
That's very valid.
As we saw in the last issue, issue 11, Scott and Barda travel to Apocalypse to offer their new son Jacob to Darkseid as an offering to end the war between Apocalypse and New Genesis. This is what happened to Scott when he was a kid. He was offered to Darkseid by Highfather to stop the war at that point. So it was a emotional issue in which the father had to do what he did to his own son. But then there was a twist in which it was all a feint, and Scott stabbed Darkseid repeatedly in the face with a knife made out of Orion and killed him. Mm-hmm. But then Metron appeared and said, hey, you're not in the right world. There's a whole other world. And showed him the New 52, and that was the big cliffhanger. So then what was going to happen in this issue? So what happens here is basically, I'm going to tell you what I originally read.
Wait, before you go, I want to make this clear to the audience. Yeah. I want people – I don't understand it.
This is true.
As of yet, I thought about it. I read it. This isn't saying it's bad, but I don't know that I've figured it out. And I figured I might need to read it again, or I'm going to ask Connor what he says, and that might save me the
time. All right. Well, I'm going to tell you what happened in it, and then I'm going to tell you what I think happened in it, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Because it's not laid out on a silver platter. You have to work for it. So first, there's an opening page in which Scott's doing a trick in front of a bunch of comic book luminaries and celebrities in the audience, including Den DiDio, Jim Lee, Tom King, Mitch Gerads, Paul Scheer, that guy from TVI,
that guy.
Yeah. Paul of Tompkins, a lot of people.
Yep.
And so then we sort of forgotten about the whole cliffhanger. It's not addressed. He's back on Earth. He shaves his beard. It looks better with the beard, actually. And then he's visited by many ghosts, people who have died throughout this series. And while that's happening, Barda's pregnant again. They've got a daughter coming. They end the war in a terrific scene in which Barda punches out, what's his name? This idiot.
The
Kanto.
Yeah, okay.
Brilliant scene.
Yep.
So the war's ended, and Scott's got a new, bigger family. They're talking about leaving L.A. because they need a bigger apartment. And there's a nice little Stan Lee tribute, which there's a lot of those this week by accident, of timing.
Yes.
Obviously, the character of, what's his name?
Funky Flashman.
Funky Flashman is a Stan Lee character. He's Stan Lee.
It's not a touching tribute character. Jack Kirby created him because he was very upset with Stan Lee at the time.
Right. And then there's a callback to the first issue with,
by the way, scene. that was some of that factual history we were talking about. Exactly. Right there.
There's a callback to the first issue with the scene of the boy in school, which I took to be sort of showing Jacob as he gets older.
Yes.
And then some stuff goes down with ghost conversations. And then it sort of ends and says, that was the adventures of Mr. Miracle, with Scott and Barda cuddling on the couch, talking about their future together. So at first I was like, oh, interesting. This isn't going to go well for people. I was like, I really like that, but I put it down.
Sort of a Sopranos moment.
Yeah. So before I get into what I think happened, tell me what you thought.
All right. So for me, the experience of the book largely lies in me trying to sort out what the underlying metaphor is. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of this has to do with, to me, the struggles of parenthood and marriage and how some of that can seem overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so with this, that's who Scott Free is to me. He's sort of trying to make his way through this world, and there's just way more stuff than he can bear. Now, we all feel like that, but he's actually the scion of Apocalypse. So that, he's got this whole other thing. Like, so the sort of extra weight on his shoulders is an extraordinary metaphor for, I think, what a lot of parents and adults feel today in our world. Mm-hmm. So that is how I tend to experience it, more than like trying to explain what the specific beats are and how it fits into canon or whatever it is, or like that. So I read it as a coda on that, which is, you know, you keep going, you do the, you know, you do the stuff, your family's growing. He finds a lot of joy in his immediate family. And then the rest of the stuff is stuff that he has to deal with in order to do it. You know, he gets along with his wife. They have some disagreements, but they get together. And that, to me, has been the theme of the whole thing. So I saw that through the whole thing. And if nothing else, you know, like with when the Allfather shows up and, you know, Scott basically gets past him by, you know, by kicking him out and being like, you're, you know, you're full of shit, or fuck you is what he says, but or squiggly sign you. But I don't know specifically, like it feels like he's dealing with internal demons. I haven't figured out if it was real, if he's real, if what it is. But in the end, I don't know that that matters to me. So right. It's not really a Sopranos type ending. It is in the effect, I think, in that people are like, what the fuck was that? But that part's actually less important.
Well, yeah, the journey is always more important than the destination.
And that's always how I've looked at this. And also, I like to look at it.
So I think that's a perfectly valid way to interpret it, because there is a lot going on in the book. And as a father, you're obviously going to interpret it stronger to that side. Now, knowing what Tom King has said, and that is that every comic he's done so far has been his attempt to work through the psychological fallout of being in war, I look at this a different way. Here's my rundown. So the first ghost is Granny Goodness, and she says, you're living in your head. You had your chance to go back when Metron revealed the truth to you, but you didn't go back. You've escaped to your head. Forager says, you killed yourself, and you're living in hell in this constant state of war where war never stops. You can't save everybody. People you love keep dying. Orion says, you killed yourself. This is heaven. You've reached your pinnacle of family. You've got your wife. You've got a son. You've got a daughter in the way. You're living this perfect family life. You killed yourself, and you're in heaven. Darkseid doesn't say anything. Highfather says, you went up against the anti-life equation, and you lost because you weren't strong enough. And then Oberon says, it doesn't matter. It's all fake anyway. You take all those together, and it's all pretty much laid out for you in that he went up against the anti-life equation. He lost. He killed himself, which if you go back to the very first issue, the first image we see is him laying on the floor bleeding out from cutting his wrists. Right. And then he wakes up in the hospital and says, Barda, you used to have blue eyes. Now you've got brown eyes. That's the first big clue that he's not in reality anymore.
Okay.
So he went up against the anti-life equation. He killed himself. He's in this new world in his head or wherever it is that is both heaven and hell. He's got the heaven side of his family and the hell side of the war. And it doesn't matter anyway because he's a comic book character and it's all fake. And that's – so to me, everything the ghosts tell him is true in this issue.
Uh-huh.
He's been in his head since he killed himself in the very first scene of the first issue.
So is he actually dead?
Well, it doesn't matter because he's a comic book character, as Oberon said.
So now what I'm doing – yeah, no, and I like that. That's fine for me. So now what I'm doing is going through the book and looking at Barda's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They're conveniently shut or not colored in a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the scene where they are doing the ultrasound, her in the second panel, her left eye is brown and her right eye is blue.
Interesting.
In the eighth panel, both of her eyes are blue.
That's interesting.
And that is not an accident.
No.
And that's a very – you did like – did you remember that without
– No. So what I did was I read issue 11 because it had been so long since issue 11 came out. Because I just wanted to be all on top of all the details. I read 12. Then I went back and I read 1.
Okay.
I didn't read 1. I went through 1. I looked at the first scene again, and I looked at what had happened. Cause I remember we talked about in the first issue, is this a whole thing about death? Because is he dead or not dead? Because in the story, he tries to kill himself and it doesn't work. But there are subtle clues that it actually did work. And I think this issue confirms it did work, but it doesn't really matter because Oberon basically says, what does the other world matter where there's endless crises and continuities and everybody ends up okay at the end? It's just as real as the world you're living in, which is basically a big high-level way of saying you're a fictional character. It doesn't really matter which reality you're in. It's all the same.
And that's – I mean, I can go with that, and I think that is a brilliant way of getting around the, well, is this real or canon? It's like, who gives a shit?
Right.
I think. Also, on page 8, her left eye is blue and her right eye is brown. Only happens a few times in it. And at the beginning of that page, both her eyes are brown.
So that's an interesting twist on it.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is them.
It could be him saying this is – because basically he doesn't choose to go back to the New 52 to quote-unquote the real world.
Right.
He chooses to stay in this fantasy world. So that could be him saying this is where I am now. And so she becomes real there.
Or that could be, you know, or that to me, that's the creators toying with your notions of what's important and what isn't. I mean, it's such a tiny, tiny clue. Like, I had to zoom in with my fingers to see really close what that was, but there are clearly spots of color there.
I bet you can't even see that in the print version.
I don't know. But yeah, but it's there. And you, I mean, to me, that's them saying, it's them echoing Oberon. It doesn't matter. This stuff is inconsistent. Stop worrying about it.
Right. Though you're right. That is incredibly subtle. Because in the first issue, when they discuss it, like, she has like fully colored irises.
That's nuts.
And so here, this is a swipe of color.
I just want to point out that Mitch won an Eisner for doing this art, and they didn't even know the most brilliant thing that he'd done. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So to me, this all leads up to a terrific final issue, a terrific series. I think it'll be really interesting to read, go back and reread, knowing how it goes.
It really does feel like, I don't want to overblow it too much because it's hard to say when you're in it, you don't have perspective, mm-hmm. but sure. It really does feel like part of the family of books that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I would put it in a lineage with something like The Watchmen or Animal Man. When Animal Man turns to the screen, you know, and looks at the reader.
It still freaks me out.
Right. But that's like a moment. That's an important touchstone in comic books that says something important. And he's doing that here. He's doing it way more subtle. Animal Man looks at it and he screams full panel page. He yells at you. There's no way to miss it. The stuff in here is like, you can have it if you want it, if you want to look for it. Like, I needed a partner. I need a guy who's been podcasting and thinking about comics for, you know, 20 years. You know, to be able to help explain it to me. And I'm right there with, like, you know, it is not easy.
Right.
But that doesn't make it that makes it more valuable as far as I'm concerned. Like, you can enjoy it on many levels.
That's what's great about it.
At the end, that whole conversation we have, I'm still reading it the same way that I was, that I described to you before.
And it's totally valid. That's what's great about it, is it can exist I think there's a thing they're trying to do here, but it doesn't really matter what I think. It matters what you take out of the art, because art's ultimately personal.
And then the other thing is that, like, if you've gone back and read Watchmen again, right?
Of course.
Right. Every time you read it, it gets better.
Yeah, because there's more layers.
I guarantee you reread this and it's going to get better. You might need to take some time, give it a year or so, read it, give it another year, read it. I'm positive. It's just too thoughtful not to have that stuff in there.
And for then, sure.
Like that's the art that keeps giving. That's kind of amazing.
And I know they want to work together again. I'm very curious to see what they do again next.
Yeah.
Because the sheriff of Baghdad, was it Baghdad or Babylon?
It started as Baghdad. It became Babylon, and I've never shaken Baghdad.
Yeah. It was great. It was more straightforward, but it was a really interesting, and I want to say transcendent, but really incredible piece of art looking at the war. And this is a really incredible piece of art looking at fatherhood, superheroes, and the nature of existence and happiness and love and death and trauma. I'm just really curious to see what they do next now. I mean, I know they've done random issues of Batman here and there, but I'd really rather they not just do that. Let's do another. Like, keep doing those random issues of Batman, sure, but like,
yes,
I want to see what their next self-contained 12-issue story
is. Like, the thing is, there. Imagine the challenge that is now.
Oh, for sure.
So what do we do now? I don't know. Nobody move. Let's just
crippling anxiety. I mean, Tom King likes to joke about it. All artists feel it. All writers feel it. There's a lot of pressure.
He's also on a stupid run right now.
Right.
I just, like, at this point, he's going to be like, if I was him, I'd be thinking, I really need to flop on something. Just, you know, like, because, you know, every time he does it, you know, like, the expectations go up.
They should do a 12-issue deep dive on Ambush Bug and have everyone hate it.
I guarantee you at the beginning of this, they must have thought, there's a really good chance everyone's going to hate this.
Sure.
And it didn't go that way.
Obviously. I think anyone who does anything, puts it out to the world, will think that.
Yeah.
You know, I always think everyone hates the show when they listen to it. Like, that was a bad one. So that was the pick of the week. And I think it was an incredible series. And we'll talk about on the year-end show where it fits into the pantheon of the year. But, you know, this book ended up being, for me, everything we wanted it to be and talked about.
And more.
And more.
I mean, I think it exceeded every one of those expectations, which is pretty cool.
Which is too bad for Thor number 7, because any other week, Thor number 7 is the pick of the week. It was pick of the week. Like I said, Mr. Miracle was the last book I read. Thor number 7 was the pick of the week up until the very last book. Jason Aaron, guest art by Tony Moore. This is a one shot. There was a lot of there was actually quite a few issues this week that were just one shots. This was an incredible flashback tale of young Thor being completely screwed over by young Loki and Odin. And it was heartbreaking, and it was fun, and it was funny, and it was beautiful to look at. God, I just felt so bad because this is such a great issue. This was such a great single issue comic.
This was the first book I read this week. Like, I was like, all right, where we get started? And I read it, and I was like, well, there's your pick of the week. Because, I mean, right away, I mean, like, it could have been easily any week. I flipped that right after the cover, guest artist Tony Moore, and I went, oh, like, I haven't seen Tony Moore art in a while.
Forever, yeah, forever.
I was like, well, he'll got it? Oh, he's got it. Like, and he's perfect for this. Not a zombie in the book, as far as I can tell, you know, but all these sort of cool renditions of what's her name, Erica the Red, and like Loki's mask. And
well, what was great about it, since it was a flashback, it wasn't like they were wearing the modern Asgardian stuff. It was all older, so they're wearing a lot of animal horns and furs and looking more like traditional Norse gods and superheroes, and I thought that was really great.
Yep.
And it's a one-shot in which Thor is disillusioned with Asgard, so he's spending all of his time on Midgard fighting with the Vikings, and Odin's pissed that his son hasn't returned to him, and so Loki says, I can bring him back for you, and so proceeds to instigate this series of events in which he meets Erica the what?
The Red.
Erica the Red, who is the baddest badass in that clan, and they fall in love, and then Loki instigates an event in which Thor has to leave and go help an invasion of frost giants or whatever it was, and when he comes back, it's the time relativity thing. For him, it was just a couple of days, but for Earth, it was 40 years, and Erica had died, and never giving up on him coming home to her because they were in love. And it was just a tragic. It's like, fucking Loki!
It was, but it wasn't. And I think that it's really interesting that we've had a lot of tales, you know, almost this whole book, the whole story is about, you know, Odin, who has all of this power, who is not a good dude, you know, like he's not evil per se, but there's this thing that goes back and forth, and the lesson that they're trying to teach Thor, and how, like, basically, Dad, you just don't understand, which is what the whole book is. Mm-hmm. And the explanation of sort of what Thor took away from this, from the lesson that he learned from the mortal woman, I thought was brilliant. And it was very, it was like a full on morality play and fable, and you know, it just made like a really succinct point about something that, you know, has been probably made a billion times. It was done really elegantly.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked that, like that, you know, basically because she's like, he's like, I love you, and she's like, show me. And right. So like then he's learning like how to appreciate life in a way that his father, who again has all of the power that anyone could ever need or want or whatever, like doesn't get. And I like that.
And it puts him on the road to becoming worthy of Mjolnir.
Yep.
Because he wasn't at that point, and she basically says, if you want to, you know, the message to him when he comes back via the old woman on the hill was, you know, she said, show me. I hope you know what that means, my lord. And basically, then we see the hammer. So basically, I mean, something's happened between that, but, you know, the last line is what it meant to be worthy. So the woman who taught Thor what it meant to be a god, what it meant to be worthy. So basically, Erica the Red, through the heartbreak of losing her, helps Thor to become the God of Thunder, which was great. It was a really great one shot told in 20 pages, which is very hard to do.
Yep. And Tony Moore's he's got it.
Have I seen him since Fear Agent?
The last thing I can remember is the Rick Remender Frankenstein Punisher.
Wasn't that before Fear Agent?
Fear Agent.
A lot of people did Fear Agent, but
I mean, I think that was during Fear Agent. It wasn't a lot. It was just back and forth between Moore and Opeña.
Wasn't Hawthorne? Mike Hawthorne do it?
Oh yeah, yeah. He finished up the last bit. But I think it was the breakdowns from Tony.
That was 2 years ago, right?
You know what? I'd tell you to go check the calendar, but I don't think you want that.
It was like 10 years ago. So also, Cosmic Ghost Rider number 5 was briefly the pick before I read Thor. This is the final issue of the miniseries Donny Cates, Dylan Burnett, Antonio Fabella, Clayton Cowles, in which Donny Cates really sticks a time travel landing here.
You're not kidding.
In a way that I don't think most people do. So it's one of those things where time travel will always screw you. You think you've done the right thing, and at the end of the day, time is won.
There's like this and the movie Looper. Those are the two things I could think of that did it right.
Obviously, it's been the story of old cosmic ghostwriter who was Frank Castle, who has been dealing with trying to save baby Thanos from becoming monster Thanos in the future. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work out for him. In fact, it turns out that he was the one that taught Thanos how to be a monster. And I loved that scene.
Yep.
What was the line? Because, fuck.
Yeah.
Someone had to teach the boy to kill. Silent panel. Fuck.
Silent panel, the thinking about it before he came to the conclusion is the best part. I love a silent panel followed by a reaction. It's one of my favorite
things.
That's
the thing that comics can do better than anything. And it was just terrific. And then he goes off. I mean, it looks really good. The Dylan Burnett art was great.
Mm-hmm.
I also really love the scene in which he goes to the other timeline in which he's alive with his wife.
Uh-huh.
And takes baby Thanos away from them and... he had hidden him there, and his wife calls out to him, and there's a really... Dylan Burnett's art super cartoony, but there's so much emotion and human feeling in that panel.
Goran Parlavian in that way.
It kills them. But I mean, this was a really terrific issue as well. Really terrific.
Yes, and I think that we need to give Donny Cates more credit for being able to, for some reason, make Frank Castle talk like a Texan Wolverine the whole time and no one says anything. Because he's I'm like, what the fuck's this coming from? I don't care, but it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
That is not how Frank Castle has ever talked or would. I don't realize why he'd pick up a colloquial Southern accent touring the spaceways, but apparently it's happened.
Listen, time does a lot of things to a man.
I mean, it must, and I haven't heard anybody complaining about that, but it doesn't make any sense, and I love that.
Yeah, and I have definitely noticed it. I just haven't said it.
It's not like Donnie doesn't know.
Yeah.
Like he knows about this deep Marvel history. He knows what Frank Castle sounds like, but he made a decision, and he's sticking with it.
He's writing Guardians of the Galaxy, the next series, yeah. Right? Okay, yeah. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yep. It'll be a good time.
Fantastic Four, number 3, features finally the reunion we've been waiting for after 3 issues of this and however many issues of Marvel 2-in-1, which they've been reunited. They finally get to say, hey, we're back. We missed you guys.
Yeah. And every time I read one of these, I'm like, did I miss an issue? I don't care. And then I just keep going through it. For some reason, everyone who's ever been in the Fantastic Four is in this issue. I don't remember why, but there's crazy God stuff going on. And I'm back and forth with my, am I okay with Dan Slott or not? And it always sort of ends up in the same way. Like, he's obviously got some kind of gift. Like, mm-hmm. there's a thing going on here, and I actually really enjoyed it. And at the end, like, I was like, this issue, I was like, this feels like when I would pick up a Fantastic Four issue from a random pile of comics in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
and just not really know what's going on, but feel like I was reading something, you know, that was worth reading, basically.
Yeah. No, this was fun. This is probably my favorite one of the 3 so far.
Oh, I think so, for sure.
All the heroes being there was sort of a nod to Fantastic Four's past.
Yeah.
There was even a funny bit where Iceman's there, and he's like, you've never been on the team. And he's like, we've never told that adventure, true believers. Yeah. That was fun. Because that felt very much like the 80s, you know?
Yeah, and I liked that Black Panther was there, because it was a harken back to one of our oldest running stupid jokes.
That's right. So they were there really to deal with the problem while the family got to sort of reconnect. And there's even a joke. Like, what have you guys been doing while we've been fighting? Like, that was sort of a joke as well.
With all that junk going on, if they had used that and it had been a confusing mess, I don't think it would have worked. But there was plenty of scenes where it really was just the 4 of them. And then that was the important thing. And that's how they got through. And I liked the plotting. I liked how Reed Richards figured it out. I liked – that was all really nice. It was really well done. It was pretty strong. And I think that maybe that sense of humor that we were talking about as it relates to Iron Man, which for me has a rough time at times, it fits better here.
Yeah, I mean, I love that his Silver Surfer. And I think maybe there's this sort of, you know, old school Marvel cosmic corner that his sensibility really works with.
Yeah, it does.
So we'll see going forward. Because now I'd like to see them now back into a sort of a standard Fantastic Four adventure and see how that goes.
Is this a standard length issue? Maybe a couple of pages long?
No, it's 20.
Yeah, 20? That's that was a hell of a lot to happen in 20 pages.
Also, in addition to every book coming out, a lot of the books were gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun.
Well, they felt it.
This one, no, some were like definitely. This one was big. The next one was definitely gigantic.
Yes, it was. And I saw, as soon as I started the cover, I looked at Avengers number 10, but it said, our 700th issue, and I was like, stop. You stop. They're having their cake and eating it too, and it's pissing me off.
Yeah.
It's not that it's one way or the other. I don't have a preference. It's that they won't make a decision, and I want them to make a decision.
Yeah, it's like because you have Daredevil this week was like issue 611 or whatever it was. Moon Knight was 200. Like, go pick a lane.
This is what I'm saying. And also, pick a lane company-wide.
Yes.
Both companies are doing it. And to me, like, oh, man, we've talked about this like many times. But, like, when I remember being a kid and you'd see, you know, Detective Comics 600, whatever. Probably mm-hmm. that's when I got in, the late 600s. And I just thought, that's going to be so cool when they're up, you know, however many hundreds of issues later. And, like, we should be in that right now. Like, you know, people who are picking up comics are like, wow, Detective Comics, 970, whatever. Like, that should be.
You choose a bad example because that's one of the books that is in using the
old numbers. I know. But either way, you know, like, the fact is, like, if a Moon Knight comic comes out, the fact that it says 200 something, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That there, you know, maybe it's not a straight line, but there's 200 of them. That means there's a real history to it. And I think that, to me, that's what was attractive about these. I don't, you know, I don't think that something that's 40 years old to me in superhero comics is more interesting because there's more stuff to choose from.
So this is the 700th issue?
Yes. Obviously, I knew it was going to be long. I was like, all right, yep, there it is.
David Marquez, Ed McGuinness, Fraser Irving, Adam Kubert, Andrea Sorrentino. So a lot of artists in this one. And I found myself, I really liked all those artists. But I was really sad when the Marquez art stopped.
Marquez art was pretty great. He keeps getting better, you know. And I think he peaked a little while ago, and we're sort of riding that peak. And I mean that, and like he's always been good, but he'll keep doing. What was the last big mini series that he did?
Civil War II.
Yeah. Where I was like, oh, he's that guy now, which is awesome. Got the what's his name, Gorilla Man. Gorilla Man. He was in this. I was like, oh, Gorilla Man, that's fun.
There's a lot of animal characters in this.
I like, which for artists has got to be a super ton of fun.
Yeah.
If I'm going to give him any problem here, you've got on page 13, you got Captain America on a motorcycle that looks a little too small and his foot is way too close to the ground. But besides that, that was the one bit where I was like, that's weird looking. Mm. I like that this was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that there was just a shit ton of characters, and it felt very, very Avengers-like, even more so than that first issue, which was we're getting the team together and Giants, Sentinel, or Celestials show up. Like, this one was just nuts. And again, I don't hate to keep going back to this, but I am keeping going. Like, this is one of those deep Marvel things. Like, you bring out all those
Dynamo. I was happy to see Crimson Dynamo.
And Vanguard, and like I remember seeing those sort of variations when I, you know, again, when I was a kid, and I always thought that was so cool. And they're different perspective on things, and the fact that like they all started fighting with each other is like, oh, that's what's supposed to happen. They all fight before they have a team up, and you know, but it's Russian and Americans are going against each other, but the Americans are mad at Steve Rogers too. And
I wish that storyline would go away. But so here you have the Avengers fighting the Defenders, which is Namor's undersea army, and they're all pissed off. They're pissed off because he's using that name, which was nice.
Yeah.
And then the Crimson Guard, the Winter Guard shows up, which mm-hmm. is Russia's Avengers, which has a lot of analogs to the American soldiers, yep. or the American Avengers. And then at the very end, Agent Coulson is brought back to bring back the Squadron Supreme, which is the Marvel bunch of DC analogs
mm-hmm.
to fight. So there's a lot of heroes fighting hero teams, fighting analogs here. And I really love it.
Yes, and then the end you get however many pages of Fraser Irving doing a story where this new Ghost Rider hangs out with Odin for a while, and I was like, that was super fun.
Yeah,
you know, it was a really good old superhero time.
Yeah, this felt. I mean, then you had like little moments where you know Thor and She-Hulk are sort of circling each other, and everybody else sees
that. That was really fun.
They're trying to hide it, but Captain Marvel's like, Jesus Christ, and everyone knows what's going on.
And he wanted her to text her.
You get to text her for me. You really get to have those little fun team moments in the midst of these giant team fights. Jason Aaron's doing a really good job of handling it all, and I think this is the book started a little slow, but it picked up in the last couple of issues, and I think now we're in a groove with Avengers.
Yeah, and also like it just seems like the creators are having fun. It seems like Jason's having fun. Like letting it be kind of loose.
He loves this shit.
Yeah, I know.
And I say that in the best possible way.
Yeah, and it shows. You don't mean this shit. Like, this shit.
This is crazy.
Like, this shit.
Yeah. It looks like Blade's going to be one of the rotating members of the team.
Yep, that's always fun.
Quick break to talk about how you can help support iFanboy, especially as the holidays start rolling around and you need to do some shopping or you want to give some gifts. The first thing you do, patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can come become a patron. We had an uptick in membership this month. We appreciate that. We're getting closer and closer to our next stretch goal, which is a two-part goal. One is the addition of the monthly non-comics media podcast, in which Josh and I and possibly guests will talk about a non-comics media thing for an episode. And then the other goal is we will upload all of the missing video shows that were recently removed from YouTube by Discovery Networks. All of our old videos and minis, there's probably over 100 of those that we have ready to go to upload. And we uploaded the Stan Lee one this week just as a tribute, but there's a lot of other ones that aren't on the web currently. So if you want to see those shows, head over to patreon.com/ifanboy for that. T-shirt store, ifanboy.threadless.com. Here's where you can get some gifts for people. I think nothing is a better gift right now than the Nothing Makes Sense, Nothing Matters t-shirt. Doesn't matter what it's in reference to, what side of the aisle people sit on. I think this is the shirt for our times. And if you want to give that as a gift, they don't even have to like comics or even know who Jack Kirby was. Give it to your grandpa, who is very angry about things, and give it to your aunt, who's very angry about things, or your sister, or your cousin. Or
it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be angry. It can be confused.
Right.
It can be that sort of bemused acceptance. That's where I'm at. Oh, it's just like this now. So, all right.
So that's a great gift. But you can also find all of our t-shirts: the iFanboy logo, the Herm shirt, the Pickle League podcast, the Rating shirt, the If One Is Lecture shirt, and the GDAT shirt. The GDAT shirt is like your antidote to the Nothing Makes Sense, Nothing Matters shirt.
Sure.
If you want, give a gift this year. Give a gift of iFanboy. We do appreciate that. If you want to help us directly out to support us, ifanboy.com/support via PayPal to make a direct donation, a one-time donation. If you want to do that instead of becoming a patron, that's totally cool. People do that. We do appreciate it. And also, ifanboy.com/Amazon is where you can find links to our Booksplode books, as well as a general Amazon link for all your holiday shopping needs. We do appreciate everyone who does that, thinks about us when they do their online shopping. We do appreciate all the methods in which people help to keep the show supported. And this is how media works. It's listener and ad supported. So we do thank you for everyone who does that.
Indeed. We are here talking about Hey Kids Comics again. And you had asked me a question. Hey Kids Comics 4 came out from Howard Chaykin writing and drawing. You'd asked me a question earlier this week. Uh-huh. And I'm trying to remember what it was. It was like, why do you like that?
It wasn't so much that. It was more like, because we talked about this on the Patreon hangout. So that's the other thing is if you're a patron, we have a monthly hangout, which we babble for an hour about random stuff. On that hangout, we were talking about some of the books we've been reading, and because we were going through the pull list for this week. And I said I liked it, but I didn't really understand the point of it.
Maybe that's
it didn't seem to be telling an overall story. It just seemed to be sort of moments in time in the comics industry through these thinly veiled versions of real people. It doesn't seem to be telling an overall story. It just seems to be telling – you get a couple of pages in the 40s, a couple of pages in the 50s, a couple of pages in the 60s, a couple of pages in the 2000s.
So I came up with an answer for that.
Okay.
I think I answered you something before, but as I was reading it – and I think it's important because and we'll talk about this more later, but Stan Lee passed away this week. Mm-hmm. And this book was not kind to him.
No.
Or his analog, really. I find this fascinating. This subject matter, these people, the history of comics. And to me, what this is Howard Chaykin giving his overall take on everything. And also giving you, because he's strode generations, you know, he's been in several different generations of comics, and he's still involved now, like he's got a unique perspective on it. And these people, where they came from, and sort of the turmoil that was going on behind the scenes while creating these things, you know, it's not so ancient history that they're not around anymore. There's that first generation is pretty much dying off now. But I just like how it provides one point of view that's very educated on the subject, you know, as it's his take on things, or at least his take on what he thinks, you know, how sort of certain people, you know, saw it and how they went through it. And the fact that, like, he uses – This will be the first time today, but not the last time today, I say something that may be considered to be politically incorrect. But here I go. Howard Chaykin came under attack for things that people said he was insensitive about. But this underlying theme of his work always seems to be that, you know, like, he's on your side from an ideological standpoint. Like, mm-hmm. He, you know, I can't think of the dude's name, but the black guy, his artist.
Ted Whitman.
Yeah, there's a constant undercurrent of racism that he is having none of.
Yep.
And Chaykin didn't just make a point to mention it once and be like, have a moment. He keeps going back to it over and over again because this is a thing that Ted has had to deal with his entire life, his entire career. And that is so poignant to me in an industry that was very homogenous, both in the creators and in the audience. And this was the thing that people had to deal with. And he makes a point to push to that. And part of it is that, you know, these guys are like rough guys who grew up in New York City, and this Jew that, and that homo that, and it's how they talked. Mm-hmm. It's literally how those people talked. And it's almost journalistic in that way. I just like what he's doing here, and I find it really interesting. And I think I was to read it all at once, the who's and the names would become more clear. But he's also – I think he was making more of a point to do so this week or this month. He definitely made sure to call out people by their name. He gave you a roll call in the beginning.
Well, the roll call is always there, but – yeah. Because I'm constantly flipping back to it. I think I just wish there was a more linear story happening.
Maybe. I like it like this because he's covering a lot of ground this way, and it – and as long as you're getting sort of those themes across. And I also think if you were to read them like right in a row, it wouldn't be the same problem.
Yeah, I have a hard time keeping track of like...
Sure, I do too.
Like I think I didn't realize till this issue that Ray Clark was the Gil Kane character But like he's been there the whole time, obviously. He's one of the three main characters, but...
I think I did. I think we said that before. Because at one point somebody said like, oh, he draws everybody like they're gay. And I was like, Stan Lee said that about Gil Kane. And so he gave you that clue before. And then the stealing art, which mm-hmm. is the thing that people accused him of, I don't know if it's true. I loved all of that. I thought that was great. What's funny, though, is that at first he was like one of the heroes of the story, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And in this, it became much more gray. I liked that, too.
Was this the first time we had the appearance of the Bob Kane analog?
I think so, or at least I noticed it this time.
Okay.
Midnight.
Ron Fogel, who can't actually write or draw anything his name's on.
I mean, just that roll call in the beginning is great. It pulls no punches. It's like, no, this is what it is. Like the explanations. And I just dug it. Every time I think, am I going to enjoy this? And at the end, like I laughed out loud a couple of times. Like I really, but this is the thing that I am super interested in. Like he's hitting all
of
the points.
No, I am too. I just wish there was a more cohesive story as opposed to just small vignettes that I have to keep remembering who everybody is every time, which is hard. Mm-hmm. The timing in this issue was unfortunate just because it was so focused.
Sure. Yeah, I know what you mean.
If it was focused on the Stan Lee character and how not great he was, that's not that it's not true in some ways, and we'll talk about that later, but sure. Unfortunate timing to read this 2 days after he died.
It's fine. I get that.
I mean, I know all that stuff, so it was a surprise. It was very focused on this issue, just the timing was interesting. Mm-hmm. The Amazing Spider-Man number 9 I wanted to talk about because before we had complained that Black Cat being turned into a crime boss in other books didn't really make sense. Mm-hmm. For the character, didn't really do her character any service. And so here she's back to being Black Cat. I thought this was a terrific issue.
Yeah, it was a very different flair. I was like, wait a minute, are we still the same team here? Like, is it still Nick Spencer? Like, yeah, it is. It felt very traditional. And I don't mean that in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Dom Herrera line forever ago, like a stand-up. I don't mean that in a bad way, but then he would say something horrible. Anyway, there's your 80s stand-up moment for everyone. Yeah, I dug it. It was fun. I liked that. It was a subtle recorrection of where Black Cat was at. And not bang you over the head, not screw everybody else, but subtle.
Yeah, I mean, the Mary Jane and Carly Cooper scenes where Peter's ex, the cop who... Mm-hmm. is back in town, and
I had to look her up because I didn't read the Dan Slott thing.
Yeah, she was one of the. It was their relationship that really drove me off that book. Cause it was so unbelievable. She convinces Mary Jane to go to a support group for people who love superheroes, and I thought that was an interesting idea. And then she goes, and Jarvis runs it, and there's some people you definitely can recognize. Foggy's there, and Genki's there, and who else is there? I remember. I figured out three of them, but I don't remember. Anyway, the point is that. Yeah. That was interesting. Although I thought the art, the Michelle Bandini art, was good, but didn't fit the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because between Ryan Otley and Humberto Ramos, you've got some really genre-pushing, defining art. And she's just a very standard, talented artist, but just didn't fit. It came off as flatter than I think it should because it was compared to Ramos.
Sure, I get that.
I liked the issue a lot, though. It was another really good issue I read.
Yeah, it was fun.
Uncanny X-Men number 1, the reboot has happened even though the storyline leading to the reboot hasn't finished yet, which is a common thing with Marvel. Ed Brissett, Matthew Rosenberg, Kelly Thompson all shared the writing duties. Mahmoud Asrar did the art, and it was good. It was fine. So I just want to mention, because it is a big release. Clearly the young X-Men are going to be gone because they weren't in this story at all. So now we have the end of Extinction spoiled. It was a resetting. There's a lot of, what's his name, Jamie Madrox in this, even though we just had a miniseries all about him. It was fine. That's my review. It was fine.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's one of those things, like, is it good, or is it good for X-Men people, or is it fine? It sounds like I don't know what X-Men people thought.
Yeah, Ron seemed to like it, our old co-host, X-Men fan Ron. I mean, it was good. I'm going to read more. It didn't blow my doors off in a week that a lot of comics did, and sure. It certainly wasn't bad. It was fine.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Yeah. That's not necessarily going to be everybody's thing.
No, it was fine.
Good. So wait, but what are you saying though? over at Image Comics, Image put a lot of stuff out this week.
Yes,
I read Bitterroot number one, mm-hmm. written by David F. Walker, and I think I had a little hard time pinning
Chuck,
down.
But Chuck Brown was the co-writer.
Chuck Brown was the co-writer, and then Stanford Green did the art, mm-hmm. And the, you may remember that team from Iron Fist and Power Man. Was that what it was called?
Power Man, Iron Fist was David Walker and Stanford Green without Chuck Brown.
Right. Which we really liked a lot. Yes. And so I started to read this one, and it's – let's see. I'm not – what you look – tell me what the year is, but I will explain the rest of it.
Okay.
Up in Harlem at a time that is not now. I'm guessing the 40s, maybe during the Harlem Renaissance.
I just scrolled away when you told me to look, so I'm scrolling back.
Okay.
Is Harlem 1924.
24, yeah. Harlem Renaissance. We've got a story of it sort of taking place in the early jazz age, but you've got a bunch of African-American characters who are – presumably somewhat involved with maybe not voodoo, but some sort of supernatural stuff. And there's a bunch of characters that we're getting introduced to. It's hard to I'm trying to explain it, and I don't know that I can.
There's clearly a thing going on right now. We've talked about it before in comics, not just an Image, but it's very prevalent in Image, where there's a lot of stories about one group and its centuries-long struggle with monsters of some sort.
Okay. Yeah. That's
basically what this is. We had that recently with another book we just read, and obviously it's American Vampire thing, but
right.
It just felt very similar to. It's like, okay, so it's another family who secretly has been fighting.
Yes, but I don't know. I don't remember, and I would spend too much time thinking about it. But there were things there were things I liked about this. That as I went through it, I liked it more. So at first it felt a little standard, but then I remembered the thing that I had liked about Power Man and Iron Fist was this voice, mm-hmm. that Walker and Chuck Brown, they've got a thing going on, and the art has an energy to it. I really liked the mix of characters that had come up with. There's a guy who uses way too many big words, and he's really big and strong, and there's a woman, and she wants to go out and fight, but too many people have been killed, and so her grandmother won't let her, but she's super tough. And then we cut to a clan hanging, which is horrendous.
Lynching.
Yeah, where some people come out of the woods and save Rob Guillory. Sorry. That's why I thought. I was like, oh, it looks like Rob. There's a lot of stuff going on. This is the first issue, and we haven't really been introduced. But there is a flavor to it that I like a lot. I like a story that's being told by black creators that takes place in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance, and it interested me. And even on the surface, I would feel like I have read a lot of this. But I liked it. And I like the coloring. Like, the production of the whole thing is really nice.
Yeah.
Really cool book.
Well, they're a great team. I didn't love it, but I'm going to check the second issue out.
Yeah, I didn't love it, but as I went through it, by the time I got to the end, I was hooked in. I was like, oh, this is a thing. I just think there's a different voice there than I'm used to reading, and mm-hmm. and I want more of that.
Oh God, Star Wars Corner's back. It's been so long.
I won't hang out in Star Wars Corner for very long, but I do feel that it's commendable that I really, really enjoyed Kieran Gillen's Darth Vader run, and then they switched over to Charles Soule, and it became a different book. And now I guess we're 23 issues into that book. Giuseppe Camicoli did breakdowns on this, and Daniel Orlandini did the finishes on it, but mostly it's been Camicoli, and it's been like it's really good. I really like him. I've liked his work for a really long time, but. What we have here is the building of Darth. We're several issues into the building of Darth Vader's fortress/castle on Mustafar. Mustafar being the planet where he had the fight with Obi-Wan that he lost his legs and whatever, and he was the chosen one, and he has the high ground and blah blah blah. And like there's an old Jedi artifact that they found a Sith architect. Who then uses this enchanted mask to take over the body, used a robot body for a while, and then took over the body of a random stormtrooper to sort of build the castle for Darth Vader. And like, so I think they built like eight fortresses in this. It's like, nope, not that one. Nope. How about it was like a comedy bit. It's I don't know why, but for this entire time they've been doing Darth Vader comics, which is the one thing that should not work, they have been thoroughly entertaining. And I don't take them seriously because they're just sort of – they're a little silly to begin with.
What is it about Darth Vader, do you think? I mean, I obviously that sounds like I don't know anything about Darth Vader, but what is it about him as a comic book protagonist that you think works so well?
I think it's very similar to the Punisher. Mm-hmm. The classic Punisher. He was a character who really didn't have a ton of personality. He was just driven and he was utterly competent, and you just watch things happen around them. And they, you know, like the Punisher never lost.
Right.
Darth Vader never loses. Now, I know that he's the bad guy, and in the Star Wars movie, Darth Vader does lose, and he's, you know, he's redeemable, and that's his story. But that's not his stories in these books. These stories, it's the story of this unstoppable force.
Right.
As you watch other people try to deal with it, and I think that is what is interesting. And everyone else always loses. And even when Vader appears to lose, he's like, all right, I'll just keep going. Like, he's never phased. There's this, even whether he's a bad guy or not, there's this unflappable confidence to him.
Where are you in the timeline at this point?
It's obviously before Jedi.
These books were originally set between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back.
I think it still is. It might be a little earlier, though, because basically he told the Emperor, he's trying to figure out how to know the Force better, know the dark side better. So he tells the Emperor, I'm going to build a fortress over on here. So it could be before New Hope. But I'm
Vader out.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. So that was Star Wars Corner. Those are the books we're going to talk about. If you go to fmboy.com, you can find the post for the show and talk about other books you read. But let's talk about the patron pick over at patreon.com/ifanboy. Every week, every patron gets to vote to add a book to the rundown. We had a lot of votes this week, as evidenced by all the comics that came out, a record number of books where we've got votes. But, of course, on a week where we had a ton of comics, it was a goddamn tie. Of course it was.
I mean, you people should understand our commitment to you and that we even told you that.
Right. We could lie, but no. It was a tie. So we're talking about two books. The first being William Gibson's Aliens 3, number one. A story by William Gibson, written and drawn by Johnny Christmas, very appropriately named Johnny Christmas.
Who you will remember from, I remember the series, but I remember the title. Give me a minute and I will. We talked about it.
Colors by Tamara Bonvillon, letters Nate Picos. So if you don't know, Alien 3. I have it wrong in the script. Alien 3 was the third movie in the Aliens series. It was a very troubled production after the first two films were huge successes. James Cameron did the sequel to the Ridley Scott original. Alien 3 was first commissioned to be written by William Gibson, who was a hot cyberpunk writer. The script, they didn't really like it, so they mothballed it, and they ended up going with another script about a prison planet. It was directed by David Fincher, and I saw it once and never thought about it again. So then over the decades, the lore built around this William Gibson script that never got made. And so now Dark Horse is doing a miniseries adaptation of it.
Couple of points to make.
Mm-hmm.
You should go watch Alien 3 again. It's crazy shitballs. And it's totally a David Fincher movie, and it's weird, and it's not necessarily good as an Aliens movie, but it's interesting, and it's worth watching. I've watched it a couple of times.
Well, you're a fanatic, Fincher fanatic.
I am.
I just remember being utterly bored by it.
Right, but how long ago was that?
Whenever it came out. When I was
right,
teenager.
So now, but now you're going to go back, and you'd be like, holy shit, it's that guy from Game of Thrones. I didn't know he was in this. You're going to do that. That's fun. And then Rock is in it for some reason. Or am I mixing up that with four?
What's interesting about this script or this story is that it's more of a direct sequel to Aliens.
Yes, but it's in the style of Alien. Like, that's what I felt like when I started reading it.
The point being, the third one ventured way off course, whereas this one basically literally takes place not long after the second film, the ship. Everybody from the first, you know, the second film, who's still alive at the end, like it's a direct sequel. Whereas Alien 3, the one I made, was much different. Continue.
Right. To me, though, like you can always say, like, oh, the Alien, it feels like that sort of slow burn, quiet, scary art film horror movie. Aliens 2 is action adventure with aliens.
Game over, man.
Yeah, they're both brilliant.
I love them.
Alien, 1978 Alien is a genuine masterpiece of film. Aliens is like a great, great, great action adventure movie.
Yep.
I don't know this necessarily should be taught in film school, but like wonderful. They're very different things though.
Yeah.
As opposed to like Jaws and Jaws 2, which only one of which exists. But this to me felt like it was definitely continuing on the story from Aliens. Mm-hmm. I mean, it absolutely was. There were strings, but it felt a lot more like Alien. It felt quiet. It felt contained. It felt scary. It felt, you know, like you were just in one little place. It wasn't a big cast of things. The only thing that was like, I was struggling to remember like, wait, who are they talking about here? That doesn't bother me, but it was a little like, oh, you really have to kind of know Alien to get all of this.
Oh yeah. I had to go back because obviously I'm a big fan of the films, but I haven't seen them since Prometheus came out when I got excited for, and then got my hopes dashed by Prometheus and then also by Alien Covenant. So I had to go back and sort of reread the synopsis of the end just to remember who had survived and just to make sure that was the same ship, and which it all was.
Yeah.
I did really enjoy this, and I think Johnny Christmas is really good.
Yeah, he did a great adaptation. If he's taking that screenplay and making it a comic, I was like, this is excellent work.
I really like saying his name too.
Yeah, sure.
The only thing I had a problem with, this is just my own thing, is I, for some reason, in text form, I have a much harder time with like deep sci-fi gobbledygook than I do in movies. So like when there's a lot of discussions about, due to navigational software failure, Sulaco has entered territory claimed by the, like, it's just a lot of hard reading.
I agree with that. And I think that there was the bit, is it the IPP or whatever it is they're referring to?
The UPP.
Like, we don't know what that is. I don't think that's in the movies.
No, it's not. It was written by the script. It's basically, William Gibson described the script later on as Marxist in space.
Okay.
So there's like
a... Oh, yeah, I see that. I can see that right away.
The Union of Progressive Peoples is sort of the communist side of the space people.
My only other problem was we see like there's some of the characters from Aliens in here, and it's not entirely clear whoever was. So the end of it, and I haven't seen Aliens in a little while and paid attention to it. The reveal at the end of that one Marine who's in there with the burnt face, I was like, wait, who's that supposed to be?
Yeah, that's what, I didn't know that. I mean, obviously there's the Lance Henriksen android is there, and obviously Ripley shows up and the little girl. Beyond that, I don't remember anybody else who survived. So I should watch it. I don't have time to watch it.
I mean, yeah, you should always watch it.
I have a lot of other things to do.
Yeah, but you're right. So I know, like, you know, you had Paxton. I was like, well, that's not him. And I don't think it's Michael Biehn because I think he was.
Oh, you know what? I think it is Michael Biehn.
Do we? It doesn't look like Michael Biehn.
Well, it doesn't look like Michael Biehn. Yeah, but I think that's who it is.
Got his face burned by the acid. I haven't watched it long enough that I have to check that
out. I'm 90% sure it is Michael Biehn.
Well, that's interesting.
There's a 10% doubt, though. Anyway, I wasn't going to read this. I'm glad I did. I enjoyed it. We'll do the ratings now or at the end?
Yeah, no. Do it at the end. Do it at the end. Do it at the end. Let's move on.
All right. The next book that the Patriots picked was Wonder Woman number 58, featuring the new creative team, G. Willow Wilson, the writer of Ms. Marvel, and Kerry Nord, the longtime sort of journeyman comic creator whose art I've always really liked. Mick Gray and Inks, Romulo Fiat. I'm just going to apologize.
Romulo Fajardo Jr.
Correct. And Pat Brusseau on letters.
And well, you can pronounce the French name, but you can't do whatever Fajardo is. Latin or something.
I took a lot of French.
Actually, I was putting an R in there. It's not unless you left the R out.
All right, let's move on.
Romulo is a fucking great name, though.
It is a great name. I really like this. And it's tough because there hasn't been a really good Wonder Woman comic since Azzarello and Chang. I would even say there hasn't been a good Wonder Woman comic since then. And I've been really trying because I was all jazzed up after the movie and I was really surprised that they didn't do like a full-on like prestige reboot of the book. They just kept going with who was working on it and they had various people working on it and they were all sort of fine.
Yeah.
They weren't bad.
No.
This was the first issue felt like a bit of wit and personality. And I don't mean funny. I just mean like this doesn't feel like a standard. Like Kerry Nord's style isn't your house style. It has personality to it. It has life to it. G. Willow Wilson's obviously a super talented writer, and I've liked the sort of angle she's going at here, in which the god of war has escaped his prison from which the Amazons had hidden him, along with Darkseid's daughter, Grail. Mm-hmm. Steve Trevor's in trouble, and so Wonder Woman breaks the rules to go help him, and turns out Ares is inside of Steve's body. There's just a lot of interesting things here. I liked Wonder Woman a lot in it. I liked her personality. She had some.
Yep.
It was fun. I really like looking at it. I really like Kerry Nord's art. He's a guy who worked a lot in the 90s. Did he do Red? I think he did the original Red miniseries.
I recognized the name, but I didn't know from where. I was like, I've seen that name, and I was expecting it when I opened to be like another kind of, you know, kind of standardish guy, like who did the Green Lantern.
Which one are you talking about?
The Green Lantern from last week.
Yes.
I think I kind of expected it to be like that kind of style of art, and it was more expressive, and I was pleasantly like, oh, right, no, this is good, I like this. Yeah, I basically finished it up, and I went, oh, that was great. Like, I said it out loud. I was like, oh, that was great. Like, I don't want to say I was surprised, but with Wonder Woman, you kind of always expect things to be, pretty good.
Kerry Nord did a lot of Daredevil.
Okay.
In the 300s. So that was in 96. Like, the 90s, he did a good run on Daredevil with JMD Matias. And he's just one of those guys, he's kicked around. He's been kicking around since the early 90s and has drawn basically everything.
Yeah.
I like his stuff a lot.
Yeah, it was good. And I thought that G. Willow Wilson, I don't know, do I call her G? I don't know. And when you say G. Willow Wilson, it sounds like it's like Wee Willy Winky, which is, I have to say it like that. I think she struck a really specific tone and chord of definitely, like, there were soft references to the movie version, mm-hmm. like her jumping into a battle. I was like, oh, that's her thing. But you know, like you said, Wonder Woman had a personality. I think that's correct. Wonder Woman had a point of view. I think at this point in time and in history, a woman writing this character who knows how to do it is going to put stuff in there that a man might not necessarily be able to.
And this should have been the issue that was on stands after the movie came out. And I realized that all of the movie caught everybody by surprise and it would turn into this global phenomenon that no one realized. But this should have been the first issue that was on the stands that people could have – I realize this doesn't happen really anymore in any kind of real way. But this should have been the comic that a young girl could have – walked into a comic store after seeing the movie and picked up and read. This should have been it.
Yeah. And this moves me to my second possibly not politically correct statement of the day.
Oh, boy.
And I was thinking about this. Nah, it's not really that bad. It feels like it's important to have a woman writing this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, in the same way that we were just talking about Bitterroot, it feels like it's important to have black creators writing that right now as that voice. Now, that seems to be counter to the idea that a writer should be able to write. You know, any writer should be able to write any character or whatever.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive ideas.
I don't either. And I just think it's an interesting thing to sort of mull around in your head. But the fact is, the point of it, coming away from it, is that after Ms. Marvel and after this and some of the other stuff that G. Willow Wilson is writing, I read this and I thought she should just be writing superhero comics. Mm-hmm. That isn't to say she shouldn't be writing Wonder Woman, because I think that her point of view, which is actually as a Muslim woman who's writing this character, I think gives it an edge. It gives it something that – this is the same thing I talk about. It's a unique voice than what I'm used to hearing, which is what I'm used to hearing is, you know, 40-year-old educated white men or 40, 50, 60, you know, like – and they're – obviously I can relate to that. But there's a little thing here that just gives it a little twist that to me makes it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even a diversity argument. It's just a – it's not a diversity of demographics, but diversity of thought, exactly. And that, to me, that's how you learn, that's how you grow, that's how you get interesting. But I got to this, and I was like, from what I just read here, you know, there's no reason that she couldn't write Justice League, but they're not going to put her on that unless it's a monster hit. But I was like, this is just a good superhero comic, and you know, like, in Darwin could write Wonder Woman, you know, this is the only other one I can think of who's, you know, great at it semi recently. Azzarello's was a little less about her being, you know, a woman. This had a flavor to it and a feel, which really appreciate, but didn't feel out of place at all. It didn't feel, there was not a preachiness to it. There was not a political agenda. There was just a point of view, which is different.
It was good. It was very good.
It was great.
Let's do ratings. William Gibson's Alien 3, number 1 out of 5.
Ooh.
I'm going to give it, this is going to sound somewhat low. I'm going to give it 3.5 only because, as you mentioned, I had some problems. Like, which character is that supposed to be again? Who is that supposed to be? Like, there was – and if you're supposed to be recognizing these people, then they should have done a better job of either listing their names or something. So I'm just going to give it a 3.5. I did really like it. I am going to continue with it, which I wouldn't have done if I hadn't had read it from the patrons.
I am going to go with 3.75.
Repeating?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I think 3.5 feels too low, but 4 seems too high. That's why I'm there.
That's fair.
Like Gabe Hardman's Alien stuff, that's a 4. It moves. You just go with it. That was – Gabe's stuff is more like Aliens, I feel like. whereas this was more like Alien, both good. And I will still read it. Wonder Woman, I am going to go with 4.25 stars.
That feels accurate. I'll go with you on that. 4.25.
Yeah, pretty good. Certainly very good for a Wonder Woman first.
Very good, and I encourage anyone who enjoys Wonder Woman and has been not been thrilled with the comics to check it out. It was very good.
And this is one that this is my version of, if you guys hadn't picked this as the thing or hadn't tied, I don't know that I would have read it, and I'm glad that I did.
I'm glad you did too. I mean, I was going to talk about it in the rundown if it hadn't been picked, because I did read it. I wanted to talk about it, but I'm glad you had to read it to find out that it was very good.
Yeah.
All right, so there you go. Patron picks, patreon.com/ifanboy. Any patron can vote on those. But if you give it the $5 higher level, we'd like to thank you on the show live by giving you a superpower of varying utility.
That's very well put. That's your own superpower right there.
Let's thank Eric Fisher. And Eric Fisher has the power to rewind time 3 seconds.
And I just counted out 3. Are we there?
So it's like having that button on your remote control, like on the TiVo or on your DVR, that lets you go back 3 or 4 seconds. Mm-hmm. He can do that, but to the world.
You have, in your world, you have a couple of newer-ish vehicles, right?
Yes, I do.
So when I got my truck, the stereo, the radio, has like a TiVo function on it.
Oh, really? Really?
Blue, that should be. You guys have that Toyota. Yours might have that if you have the N-Tune thing.
No, the Toyota is not that new.
Okay. I was like, oh my God. And as an NPR listener, I was like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. So I don't know how exact. You can see how that relates to what you just said. Yeah. But it's a moment. I was like, and I rarely use it, but the fact that it's there just blows my mind. And it shouldn't. It's just recording a very simple, you know, small audio stream. But there it is.
The thing about 3 seconds or 4 seconds, we'll say 3, it's not really enough time to really change something major. But like if something you drop something or whatever, like
yeah,
it's just enough, time to
mash your finger.
Yeah. So Eric can do that to the world.
Can you do that thing where you snap backwards and then like snap backwards and you snap backwards again, so you can keep moving backwards in 3 second increments, which really becomes 2 second increments. Back it up like 30, 40 seconds.
He can only do it once. Okay, at a time. I think
that's a good call.
Yeah. So there you go. Eric Fisher.
Just very, very, very slowly and methodically get back to junior high and right. Talk to that girl.
And not mess it up this time.
No. No. Oh, God. I'm having a moment. I'm sorry. This is a little more difficult, but I have to name powers for Dead Zone the podcast.
Yeah.
Dead Zone the podcast.
I wonder how many people that is.
And all of its... Or maybe even just one, but any of its on-air talent.
Mm-hmm.
They have Tyrannosaurus legs. Tyrannosaurus legs. And I have been vacillating on whether they should be proportional to a human body or they should be Tyrannosaurus-sized.
But well, beyond the obvious of messing up their lives, if you make the Tyrannosaurus lives, you've really messed up their lives.
Sort of, but... Also, they can make perfect concentric circles vibrate into water.
I think they should have human-sized legs. Because they can still do the circles.
Human proportional, but Tyrannosaurus legs.
Just no pants.
And there's they don't need pants, no. And that comes with a tail. They're like Tyrannosaurus centaurs. I'm going to go ahead and give it that. And I'm telling you this right now. Any comic book artist right there who's listening to this right now went, I want to draw that. I know.
So on the one hand, you might think this is a curse, but on the other hand, you've got really powerful legs now.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You can really impress at the gym with your leg presses.
There are benefits. Yeah, there are definite benefits. Bet it's an issue, but whatever.
Ryan's not here, so I don't even know what the deal with dinosaur genitalia is, but that's got to be affected as well.
Do we even know? Did their bits survive?
He might. Next time he's on the show, we'll find out. Or I can just text him after and find out that way. Mark Abnett can instantly and expertly package up anything.
Ooh.
And the materials just appear out of thin air. It's just like boom, boom. He could package up it. Like if he literally had to ship something, he could package it up. But also he could package up a person. They could find themselves inside of a box, you know, wrapped up in bubble wrap.
Did I do a shipping rate power once?
A shipping rate power? Possibly. Yeah,
like I would know what it would cost to ship.
Maybe. I definitely did a shipping
power. This is the downfall of internet selling right here.
Oh, it falls apart. That's where it falls apart in the chain. is the shipper. Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. He can instantly package anything. So no matter how complicated it is, what size the item is, how fragile it is, if it's a human being, it's instantly perfectly packaged.
Okay.
Nothing he ships will ever break, and any evildoer he decides to package up for the cops will still breathe but be immobilized.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Bobby Baker has also got something going on below the belt.
Oh, no.
In that when Bobby steps into an area that has snow or ice, it melts. He's got snow melt feet. And it's organic. It's biodegradable. There's no problem. It's not damaging. It doesn't harm the surface.
So he's not emitting heat. He's got like a melt in his feet, like a chemical.
No, it's more like an energy wave.
I see.
Which I guess, you know, isn't heat per se, but it breaks up those frozen molecules.
And it only works on ice and snow?
Yeah, frozen liquids. So it could be other things. Like he could stand on, you know, like a cube of dry ice, and it would dissipate.
That's also ice.
Yeah. Well, that's true, but it's not water. It's frozen carbon dioxide.
So he, okay. All right, interesting.
I mean, it you know, that being the case, maybe there should be a temperature range, because a rock is technically ice also, you know, but like we'll say that things that can be liquid at our sort of standard living temperatures.
So not dry ice then.
Well, doesn't it melt if you
it
just
melts
put it,
into
like,
steam?
Right. But either way, but that's what it does at like a room temperature.
But I don't think it ever
comes
liquid.
Say you put a rock in your living room at room temperature, it will not melt, but a cube of dry ice will.
I guess melt is technically correct. Yes. All right.
Yes.
All right. So those are the powers. Yeah. Eric, Dead's on the podcast. Mark, Bobby.
I am absolutely going to get a text from Ryan this week.
So check. Thank you for supporting us, and enjoy your powers. Patreon.com/iFanboys, where you can get them if you want to support the show at the $5 or higher level and get your powers in the show. We are making our way through the list slowly but surely. It may not seem like it, but we are. And normally this is where we have a listener mail. I know we're already probably long. I can't tell, but I know we are. But we're going to talk about Stan Lee. Obviously, very sad week. He passed. Although somebody asked me if I was really sad about it, and I thought, you know, it is sad, obviously, for him, for his family, for his friends, his colleagues, people know him. But also, I mean, he was a month shy of 96 years old, and I think at that point, it's always sad when someone dies, obviously. But it's also like, he lived a full life. It wasn't like he was a 35-year-old man who dropped dead. He lived the full, almost century-long life.
Yeah, he wasn't even a 65-year-old man who dropped dead.
He got a good run.
I think that's a really good question, because my first instinct wasn't to be sad, and I did not shed a tear, and this is not a person to whom I am not attached in many ways, both as an icon and just personally as a sort of experience in my life. But I think you're right. Like, I don't feel like I was sad about it, because I feel like it was a life, man, you know. And also, like, his wife had died a couple years ago, and his story kept getting sadder, and I just, you know, I'd hear that he was still at shows.
Yep.
And I thought, that can't be, I don't know. You know what? I'm actually, as we go through whatever this is going to be now, he's a man of startling contradictions internally and externally. So I do have the thought, like, why is he still going to shows? He's not going to be wanting to do that. And then I think, actually, maybe he does. Like, I can see it either way.
But obviously, he's the last big legend from the original, not the original era, because comics were before him, but from the original, you know,
Golden Age,
Renaissance, which was really sort of the Silver Age.
Right, but he was in the Golden Age.
Yeah, so. The original, you know, obviously Marvel people. I think he was being mischaracterized in the news, but it doesn't really matter. He's the person responsible, along with a lot of other people, for shaping the comics you're reading to now. He's the last one alive from that era. You know, Steve Ditko died earlier, and obviously Kirby died a long time ago. To many people in the world, he is comics, and that was probably the big thing, is that he was the immortal symbol of comic books, no matter
to
what.
Yeah, to anyone our age and probably above and below that, he's the first comic creator you were ever aware of, by far.
Right, but even then, the movies have turned him into this icon. Even he was always an icon, but the movies really turned him into an icon. And everyone has seen those movies, and everyone knew who he was. He was the symbol. When you thought of comic books, you thought of Stan Lee. Anytime anyone who didn't know anything about comic books talked to you about it, it was always something about Stan Lee, because he was the living symbol of it. And for us, he was always that, because he narrated the cartoons. He did the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends intro, and like he was always Stan Soapbox and the
Stan
and
Soapbox, absolutely.
Even if he wasn't making the books, you thought he was you were a kid, because his name was on everything, and he was Stan Lee Presents Spider-Man, and you thought he was doing it, and he turned himself rather cannily into the face of comics,
even which not is just Marvel, brilliance.
Comics, yeah.
And I think that that's right there where you get a lot of the quote unquote obituaries got it wrong, because like they credit him as the creator of Marvel Comics or sometimes the sole creator of all these characters, whatever. And he had a hand in it, but larger than that, I think, was his giving a personality to comics as a community, as a whole, you know, through Marvel Comics, but also just as a sort of symbol and an attitude that I think pervades today. Mm-hmm. Which is the way that he did that. I don't know how much of it was cunning or craftiness, but it was brilliant in the end, one way or another, whether he was just sort of, you know, following his instincts or what. Yeah.
He lived a fascinating life, and you mentioned this on social media. There are a handful of really good books about it. If you don't know about Stan Lee beyond just the image, the smiling court jester of comics, mm-hmm. the ambassador of comics, you should really read him, because we can still celebrate and mourn and also recognize that there was a lot of things that were murky about his career and a lot of things he may not like. And that's going to be true about anybody in the world.
I mean, that's the thing that's interesting about it. If you're paying attention, the books are I'd recommend Stand the Man by Tom Spurgeon and I forget who the co-author was, or Tales for Astonished by Ronan Rowe, or Sean Howe's The Untold Story of Marvel Comics. All of those help paint a picture, which, and I've read all of them and more, and I can't make my mind up about Stan Lee. It's not even in a bad way that he's a lot of things, as was Jack Kirby, and to cast him as a hero or a villain is wrong. To cast him as both is wrong, or either. Like he's this singularity of a human who has affected, if anybody who's affected by comics in their life has been affected by him.
Yep.
And you know, he did a lot of things that were really good, and he may well have done things that weren't great, but I tend to feel like a lot of those things that weren't great were him being pretty damn human and trying to find a way to express that. I think he's a very complex and interesting person. And the fact is, that ambassador thing, that face of comics thing, that is a very small part of who he was. And he's actually fairly protective of the rest of it. I always think of the fact that when people talk about him from the era of the 60s, you know, a lot of those bullpen folks in the comic, they would go out together, they would have drinks, and they would hang out. And Stan would go, but he would sort of sit on his own, and he would leave early. And I always think of that. Like, he was not part of that group. Mm-hmm. He was separate from that. He was
the boss.
He was, but also, you know, but Roy Thomas went and did that stuff. You know, like I felt like I'm so like poetically unnecessary, but there's a bit of a longing about him mm-hmm. that I don't think was ever resolved.
Well, he always wanted to be more than a comic writer, and that was dealt with this week in Hey Kids Comics when he went out to try to sell his novel. But when he was making the comics weren't a thing to be proud of. Mm-hmm. Or to even brag about. It was sort of things just you did until your novel got sold or you got a different writing job or worked in a magazine. So I think that you probably never shake that, even as you get older and comics become this global phenomenon, and not the comics but the characters, and you become a global phenomenon. I think it's hard to shake. Most people haven't shaken high school, you know? It's hard to shake that initial disappointment in your professional life, in your personal life. It's always sort of sticks with you in the back of your mind. I don't know that it did with him, because he said he was very personal. I mean, we've met him many times. We interviewed him quite a few times for iFanboy. We just, as we said, we've posted a long interview we did with him on video. We did, I don't know, 4 or 5 interviews with him over the years. But, you know, you don't ever know him. He doesn't ever know you. But he did know some people, and we know somebody he did kind of know. And I remember talking to them. The Stan Lee documentary that came out, I don't know, 6 years ago, we were at the premiere for it here in L.A., and he was like, you know, Stan doesn't remember any of it. And this was 6 or 7 years ago. He has his stock stories, and you can't press him for the details. He doesn't remember them. He's just been too long. His memory's starting to go.
And there's so much of it, too. Where we do have a bit of a unique perspective on this is that I've met him several times over the last, I want to say the first time was 15, 16 years ago, maybe a little more than that. I interviewed him for a TV show, and mm-hmm. this was sort of just after comic book movies were starting to take off. He'd made a couple of cameos, not really, like, people knew him, but almost more at that point from, if you weren't a comics person, you knew him because of the Stan Lee media stories or something like that. And then 11 or 10 years ago, a little over that, we all went to his office and interviewed him for the first time. We did it several times after that. And
well, that wasn't the first time. The first time was that really quick one we did at New York Comic Con.
Okay, yeah, you're right. But then when we, right, but either way, that when we went to his office and interviewed him there, that was like, that was a really special thing for me and you. And like, I wasn't even exaggerating when I said that's the high point of my iFanboy career. That day was about, I was like, we're doing this thing. It was a really big deal for me. But the point that I wanted to make, though, is that when we were in that room with him, and any times I've been in that room with him, he might have just been telling, reeling off stock stories, but boy, it felt like, you know, we were connecting. It felt like we were talking. He made you feel good about yourself.
Well, that was one of his main gifts, I think.
Yeah, and but like I also remember, so in the when I interviewed him for that TV show I used to work on, 2002. I'm going to say it's two. You know, like I put him on. We were doing a mini documentary about the guy who climbed the outside of the World Trade Center in a Spider-Man suit. Mm-hmm. And I one thing that I would do is I would figure out how to get interviews with people who would be germane to the show, who I also wanted to meet. And so that was the first. I was like, you know, why don't we call Stan Lee? I bet he'll do it. And so we went there and we interviewed him. And I didn't do the interview, but I set the whole thing up. And like a couple of weeks later, I got a handwritten thank you note from him. And it was him. It was his. Yeah. It was his handwriting. It wasn't a Xerox from. And I just thought, wow, what a freaking class move. And I am, but boy, I was really nobody at that point. And you're right, that's his gift. But he was a really genuine person to be around. I don't think he was. I don't think it's a fully faking thing.
No. And there was a brief controversy a little bit after he died when the actor Armie Hammer complained that everybody was posting photos of themselves with Stan. And I would genuinely agree with him about the idea of grieving. Yes. On social media tends to become a narcissistic exercise. However, I think it's different with Stan because I think part of his gift was that people were really happy around him, and he was really happy about people who were happy around him. And I think that was what you saw in all those photos with people.
And those photos are genuine big moments in those people's lives. And if that's how they relate to that, I mean, I did it. We did it. Like it.
Right. Because I think that was kind of what he gave was everyone who met him was extremely excited to meet him. And he fed off that energy. And I think that was part of it. It wasn't just about posting a picture of Stan from the 70s in the bullpen. It was, this is what he gave to people, was it a joy, and you could see it in everyone, their faces. And so I really liked seeing all the photos of people with him because, you know, we know, we've been there. He gets really happy about meeting people who are really happy about meeting him, and it's fun. It's super fun.
Yeah, he really was like a special thing. And it's interesting, on that day that he died, that was the best, most positive day I've ever seen on comic social media in a decade.
Right. Which is really interesting because 5 years ago, comic social media was trying to take him down. You know, there was the pro Kirby movement that really sort of manifested into a anti Lee movement.
And to do that is to not understand Kirby or Lee.
Right. And but you recall that was a thing for a while, where it's like every mention of Stan Lee was spit, and everyone was throwing Kirby on their shoulders, not wrongly, but it became this really weird discussion that wasn't. It felt wrong because it's a very gray area. Obviously, Kirby didn't get the respect and the rewards he should have, obviously, but so did a lot of people didn't.
Also, it is my opinion, somewhat educated, that Kirby didn't help himself in a lot of situations. That is another conversation, but he has to take some of the responsibility, too.
But the point is, it was interesting to see that because not that long ago, people were really had the knives out for Stan.
Yeah. And it's still like a stupid punk rock kind of thing. Well, Stan was just like, but it's just not that simple.
Yeah. I think that's the whole point of this, is that you should absolutely celebrate it more. And even knowing there may be things he did you didn't like or disagreed with, that's life.
And learn from it.
Yeah.
I mean, like there's lessons to be learned from it. I don't think that Stan thought he was without fault. And if you pay attention to everything Stan said, at least over the past decade plus, I mean, he used every chance he could to talk up the creators that he worked with and talk about their genius. He also had more of a hand in making a lot of those artists' household names along with himself. I mean, everybody got a nickname, everybody got a personality, everybody got a platform, and that's
he made them characters. I mean, he turned the bullpen into characters, right? So that was we mentioned this earlier in the Stan soapbox, and you know, you didn't know who was doing the DC Comics. Mm-hmm. You saw the Bob Kane's name on Batman books, but he wasn't writing and drawing them. But right. What Stan did was he pulled the curtain back on Marvel and said, here's, you even knew the secretary's name. Like, you knew everyone's name working on the books. As you said, they all had nicknames. They all had like personalities. They would do caricatures of them. You knew who was making the books. And that's actually a major thing that he did that happened, because you didn't know. They just sort of came out and you read them, and it could have been made by robots for all you knew. But now you knew who all these Marvel people were. And that continued on. You know, now, you know, then the Romitas came in. People of the second generation, Roy Thomases, and they all stuck with that of turning the Marvel creators into characters. Now everyone knows who everyone is involved making the comics, and that was part of it as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of things, we're not doing the show without Stan Lee.
No, absolutely.
There is 100%. Not an industry like this without Stan Lee. For good or for bad, we're not doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obviously sad for the industry, but like I said, a man who lived a full life, lived nearly 96 years. As I said to somebody, he was basically in overtime, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
As I said, it's sad, obviously, but also it's like 96.
Nice job.
He did a good job. He really lived. Yeah. He did the most of those 96 years.
Yep.
You know, pour one out for Stanley Martin Lieber. And he is Stan the Man. He'll always be Stan the Man. And then he's going to keep showing up in those movies.
They're going to uncanny valley him.
They will eventually. I believe they've shot some just generic cameos that they haven't used.
That'll be a moment.
I also know that he has been body scanned.
Oh, boy.
I didn't know that for a fact.
Here's a fun fact. He's taller than you think.
Yes, he is. He's very tall.
I was like, oh, he's like a big dude.
Before we wrap it up, I just would mention that day we did go to his interview to interview him. The video we just posted was incredible. Also because we've done this a lot. He had no handlers.
Yeah,
they literally,
true.
They put us in a room with Stan Lee by himself in his offices. Was it four of us? There was three of you on camera. There was five of us because it was me and the other guy from TRS were off camera.
Oh, David Briggs.
Just us and Stan. And that's very unusual, especially for someone of his stature, to not even have like an assistant in the room or a publicist or someone. I mean, there was a really dark joke. Man, we could have murdered Stan Lee and no one would have stopped us because we were five people alone in this 85-year-old man. But that was also part of his charm, right? Like he just walked in. He owned the room. He remembered you in that moment.
Yep.
And he had a little something for everybody in the room. He made you feel like a part of it.
And he would joke. Like, he was fast.
He took photos with everybody. He was happy to do it. We could have kept hanging out and talking to him if we wanted to. Try doing that with someone of similar stature in another industry. Yeah. That would not happen.
Nope.
So there you go. Stan Lee. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. He said a lot of it himself.
There you go. Sad week, but also a good week to remember him.
Definitely. All right. Let's wrap this sucker up.
All right, so real quick, as we hit towards the end of the year, obviously Dreadnoughts Legends number one, my comic that I edited, is still on Steam and Comixology. You can check it out. Paul Montgomery and David Acampo were the writers. Priscilla Petrades and Marco Lesko were the artists and colorists. If we get enough interest, we'll do more. We have the second through fifth issues outlined. So if you want to read more of those adventures, buy the issues, leave us reviews. We would appreciate that.
Blow it up, people. Get that done. You can also go ahead and listen to our Books Blowed episode where we figured out what My Heroes Have Always Been Junkies was eventually throughout that episode. It is a criminal story from Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. But even if you've never read any of that, it is worth the time. We talk about that in a nice little show that's out. And then just behind that was our Talks Blowed from last month, which featured cartoonist Katie Cook, who was a hoot.
Holiday schedule. So there's three more Pick of the Weeks for the year. 661 is next week, 1125 for Thanksgiving, 662 December 2nd, 663 December 9th. And then we break on the Pick of the Weeks until January 6th. We'll return to 664. But in that break, there'll be three shows for you to enjoy. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse review, our End of the Year Spectacular, the All Media podcast will be coming out on 1216. And then the Aquaman review show happening whenever that movie comes out. I think it's the 23rd. I have it wrong here in the script. But there'll be three shows in the break for you to enjoy while we're on our holiday break. And also, if you're a patron, the December patron hangout will be on December 2nd, our wrapping up of the year. I thought that the November one was super fun, Josh. That was one of the more fun ones we did.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was funny because it was completely formless.
Yeah, Megan was like, "Do you have stuff planned?" I was like, "Nope, nothing planned."
We were well into it before. I was like, "We got nothing here. Let's keep going."
So a lot of content for you in the rest of the year, even if we are taking our regular break.
Rad. You can go over to ifanboy.com. You can comment on this show. Share a Stan Lee memory that you have there.
That actually would be really great to do that.
Yeah, because everybody's got a good story. I've never heard a bad one. Maybe you have a bad one. I'm fine with that, too. I want to know what your story is. You can find all of our other podcasts. We have done stuff. And we did talk about that Stan Lee show, which we put up. It's on YouTube now. It had been taken down. So if you haven't had a chance, I watched through it again.
Go to youtube.com/ifanboy. If you've never seen any of our video shows or the Stan Lee interview, it was 45 minutes or so of with Stan Lee, and it was a really good one. So check that out.
It was YouTube.com/ifanboy. I thought he was going to kick me out at one point. I was like, no, he's playing around. This is great. you can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out at facebook.com/ifanboy or at ifanboy on Twitter. And you can follow us individually at Jay Flanagan on Twitter and Instagram and at CS Kilpatrick on Instagram as well.
And if you like the show, leave a review on iTunes or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Even if it's not a written review, you can leave a star rating. That helps helps people find podcasts, and we do appreciate that. Do it for any show you listen to. That would be a nice Christmas gift for them, or any holiday you celebrate this year. And even better than that is to tell your friends. Word of mouth is the best marketing tool. When people ask what podcast you listen to, if they're asking for comics ones or not, we always appreciate when people mention our show, and we do thank you. And this is a long one, but we had a good time talking about Stan, so next week is Thanksgiving. It's a Thanksgiving show, and until then, I'm Connor.
And I'm Josh. And that book that Johnny Christmas worked on was Sheltered.
Tremendous impact on yes. young people today. They, it's a funny thing. Very often I'll come to stations like this and do interviews, and I can't tell you how many times I've gone, let's say, to a television station, and the cameraman, somebody in his 30s maybe or late 20s, will walk over to me. It makes me feel very old, but he'll say, "Hey, Stan, gee whiz, I've been reading your stuff since I was 14. Tell me, how's the Hulk doing today?" and so forth. And this wasn't the case many years ago, but somehow with the new type of comics, better written, more relevant, the readers are not leaving the comics or losing their interest as they reach the age of 14, let's say, the way they did years ago. But comics seem to have more of a staying power with people who are picking them up in the past decade or two.
It may be that the writing style is becoming more and more valuable and significant, and that you are using the words that are meaningful.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Stan, thank you very much. Stan Lee, publisher of the Marvel Comics Group.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, like, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.